Welcome to the CNI Conversations for June 22nd, 2011. This is Cliff Lynch, the director of CNI, and we have a couple of things on the docket for today. Joan Lippincott is going to talk a bit about the Digging into Data reporting conference that was recently held in Washington, D.C. I will say a few words about a meeting on identifier interoperability that I attended, and also talk a little bit about some recent developments at the German DFG. We'll conclude the report with Joan giving us some highlights of a recent symposium put on by the National Research Council's Board on Data, on Research Data and Information, or BERDI. So let me begin with digging into data. This is a very significant large-scale project that was launched about a year and a half ago, I believe. I actually was one of the proposal reviewers for it. It brought together funders from multiple countries, and the awards were to international teams. It also, within the United States, saw NEH, NSF, and IMLS all working together on the agenda. So I will pass it over to Joan, who will talk a bit about the some of the things that are coming out of that program.
This conference, which was a couple of weeks ago, focused on the current 8 digital humanities initiatives in this Digging into Data challenge. And the deadline has just passed for a second round of the grant program with increased sponsorship by now 8 agencies in more countries in this phase. So we'll have continued support for digital humanities research. Just to give you a flavor of what these projects are like, I'm going to describe one of them called Mapping the Republic of Letters, part of the Digging into the Enlightenment project. And the researchers started with a question: what did the correspondence networks of the time, the 18th century, really look like? They based it on large collections of letters that were already digitized from major philosophers of the time. And the design challenge was how to visualize 50,000 letters. And these were published digitized letters, not from an individual letter here or there from manuscript collections. But 70% of the letters were not already associated with location data. So that was one of the challenges. The way that the researchers constructed their project, the visualization serves like a browser to go back through the letters. It gives us a new way of asking questions like, why did Voltaire have so little correspondence with people in England after he'd lived there for several years? Most people have assumed that Voltaire continued to have a lot of interaction with British philosophers, but when they mapped the letters, they found that was not the case. And they also looked at patterns of correspondence, whether the ranges were regional, national, what they called cosmopolitan, or global, and found that most interaction was regional. There wasn't as much cross-national interaction among these philosophers as they anticipated. One of the presenters, Chris Weaver, called data visualization our next general-purpose methodological science. And I thought that's a really profound comment and has implications for questioning how do we teach our up-and-coming humanities students about this new methodology. The reactor, Stephen Nichols from Johns Hopkins, commented that usually the information in letters was the focus of this kind of research when, you know, humanists and especially historians or literary critics often examine letters, but they're looking at the content. Now it's the metadata of the letters that's enabling new types of analyses, and the kinds of geospatial mapping systems that are available are giving us new insights into this digital content. Some of the themes that emerged from the 8 presentations, each of which had a reactor, were these. The digital humanities is a collaborative endeavor, does not follow the traditional humanities model of the solo researcher. And digital humanities not only are not well understood because they're collaborative efforts, but many traditional humanists do not understand the outputs of their work in terms of promotion and tenure requirements. And while there is some work being done both at the professional association level and the institutional level, the progress so far has been very slow, and it needs to continue to change in order to reward these efforts, especially to encourage younger or newly minted humanists to go into the digital humanities. Another theme, examining large data sets allows researchers to ask new types of questions while retaining the overall mission and character of the discipline. Also mentioned by several presenters, integration of data from multiple sources is fundamental to many types of humanities and social sciences research. This is in the analog environment as well as in the digital environment. But in order to really be able to mine across types of resources, we need more data standards, and we need to work on collaboration and wider sharing across fields. Another interesting outcome of the talks was a window in to see that many undergraduates are involved in these projects, particularly in the coding of the data. The researchers acknowledged that graduate students in the humanities need better technology training, and I asked one speaker about the need, in addition to technology training, for training in IP issues, data standards, and privacy, and he agreed that those were important as well, but acknowledged that that kind of training is generally not taking place. Finally, I just want to mention one of the keynote speakers, Tony Hay, well known to CNI audience as one of our keynote speakers, and Tony was a key leader in the development of e-science in the UK, and he demonstrated some projects sponsored by his current employer, Microsoft Research. One is a collaboration with UC Berkeley called ChronoZoom. It's an interactive timeline for big history, meaning history in the earth and planetary sciences. Tony demonstrated a project feature where you could browse the bibliography of an article in which tiny images of papers in PDF form are embedded so that you can just zoom in and read the entire article while you're browsing the bibliography. I found that was a very appealing tool and one that would really transform the way we think about digital libraries. So that's a brief summary of digging into data. There's lots more. The proceedings are not out yet, but if you Google digging into data, you'll come to the website and you'll find lots of information on the projects, and eventually, I believe by the end of the summer, there will be proceedings from the meeting. Back over to Cliff.
Thanks. The Digging into Data program really is very interesting, and I think some of you may have seen some of the press coverage of the meeting that Joan was just reporting on that appeared in the Chronicle of Higher Education. It's worth noting that this program really is about digging into data, not just text. While the particular project that Joan talked about was kind of text-oriented, and there are several others that are very textual. There's one I love where they're working with the digitized transcripts of the trials at the Old Bailey in England. So you've got sort of several hundred years of crime history, and in it, you know, a wonderful window into the sort of changing views of crime and of social classes and all kinds of things that weave in there. But several of the projects, if I recall, really were dealing with multimedia content of various kinds, spoken word or other sorts of material. So it's a very rich agenda. I'll also note in the area of data and text mining a report that's come out this week and that I will be putting a pointer out to CNI announce on later today. This is a report that was prepared by the Publishers Association that was looking at text mining of the scientific literature, and they interviewed a whole pile of people, including me, over the last few months to collect views on what was likely to happen, what was in terms of mining the scientific literature, what were the key obstacles, and what were the likely sort of outcomes from this. This is the first thing I've seen like this that really is very much from a publisher perspective, and while I'm only partway through it, I think it's certainly an interesting look at some of the thinking from the major STM publishers about how data mining might be supported. The next thing that I want to talk about is a meeting that was convened by the SURF Foundation in the Netherlands to look at developments in persistent identifiers. And let me give a little background on the whole area. So some years ago, of course, at least a decade, we realized that persistent identifiers were going to be crucial for being able to build up digital collections over time, reference them, keep track of digital objects. And there was quite a bit of work done both in the IETF context with uniform resource names and by groups like Bob Kahn's CNRI, which developed a system called Handles. There was a lot of thinking about what should be the sort of foundational principles for these, how they should link together. There was a lot of fussing about the appropriate syntax. And then things kind of quieted down as people got on with building systems. So you saw Handles and a number of systems that derive from Handles or specializations of Handles, such as the DOI that came out of the publishing community and is now actually being used by quite a number of different purposes, including as a potential scheme for data citation through the data cite program. You've also seen a lot of large cultural heritage organizations that are running big digital archives or collections of material do local identifier systems. Many of the national libraries are doing this, for example, in Europe. So one of the things that the SURF Foundation was interested in doing was kind of taking a look now that we've got some deployment experience. They have some particular issues that are coming up in contexts like Europeana, where they're pooling cultural heritage material from a number of national libraries, And so they wanted to start looking at issues around policy interoperability for identifiers, and they've done some very nice work trying to lay out some of those issues through a program called PERSID, Persistent Identifier, that they've been running. And this was an opportunity to vet some of the results coming out of that. I think it's very timely to see this kind of new look at identifiers, and in particular a much more explicit recognition that we're not going to have, you know, one identifier to rule them all, but in fact are going to need to operate in an environment where we've got multiple identifiers that have to coexist in constructive ways. My understanding is there will be some proceedings from the meeting. I also have seen a fair amount of documentation, which should be accessible through the CERF Foundation website, on the products of the PERSID project. So good reading for people interested in identifiers. I'll also note, just in talking informally with colleagues at the meeting, that the issue of author identifiers seems to be surfacing as a real concern in Europe as well as in the States. I talked in an earlier conversation about the ORCID program, and I think this just sort of reinforced my sense that this is going to be an issue that certainly is going to be getting more serious attention over the next year or two. The final thing I want to report on before turning things over to Joan again to conclude this conversation is a workshop that I attended yesterday that was put on by the DFG. The DFG, and I'm not going to butcher the German full name of it, is an science funding organization in Germany that actually funds not just science, but medical work and also humanities. So you can almost think of it as like our NSF, NIH, and NEH all rolled into one. They have been, of course, like many of the major science funding agencies, very concerned with the management of digital data from scholarly work and how to archive and facilitate reuse of data that is produced through scholarly investigation. They have recently funded informatics infrastructure on the order of 30 projects positioned at major universities in Germany. And they had a couple of their program officers coming through the States to talk about this program and about some of the efforts that they've funded. We're talking about a pretty large-scale program here on the order of 10 million euro. And it's quite interesting. The centers that they've funded have disciplinary focuses, and I would have expected prior to seeing the material that science would dominate. In fact, humanities dominates. More than half of the centers are dealing with some aspect of the humanities. There are a few projects in science and engineering, but it's quite different from the situation in the States, where there's quite a lot of funding going into informatics for the support of science and medicine, but much more limited funding going into the kind of digital humanities work. There's certainly lots of enthusiasm for the digital humanities work, but when you just sort of look at it on a scale of funding basis, it's a much smaller scale activity. So I think this is a very interesting development. Obviously, some of these centers are just getting started. I think there's a view that they really want to build up specific centers of disciplinary expertise at different universities as kind of a complement to the sort of scientific centers and expertise that one sees from institution to institution. I'm hoping that we will be able to have one or more presentations on some of the work funded under this program at our upcoming CNI member meetings. And with that, I will say goodbye and hope to see some of you at the American Library Association meeting in New Orleans in coming days. And I'll turn it over to Joan, who will conclude the conversations broadcast with discussion of the Bertie Symposium.
Thanks, Cliff. In mid-June, I attended some sessions of the National Research Council's Board on Research Data and Information, or BERDI. There was a public symposium on crowdsourcing, improving the quality of scientific data through social networking. Crowdsourcing in this context is not just amateurs on the loose participating in science. Scientists develop questions and create frameworks in which citizens can participate through observations and contributions of data, which are then analyzed by the scientists in their work. I'll describe two of the projects I found most fascinating. At the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA, they want to reduce uncertainty by increasing observations. They have scanned weather data from 1830 to 1970 from many countries, but the scanned data are in image format, and they've found that trying to do automatic conversion of these to make them searchable is not easily done, because often the images are handwritten, so there are handwriting issues. They're grouped in columns. There are even some are written sideways on one side and vertically on another. So it's a very complicated type of document. So they decided to involve amateurs, because otherwise it would take them probably 200 years to actually transcribe all of this data to get it done. So this particular project is at oldweather.org. It analyzes weather data collected by the British Navy during World War I. What is really terrific about this concept is that at this site, the amateur becomes part of a crew of a ship, and that's like a real actual ship, and then can advance as in a game by transcribing weather records, so they can achieve new levels and kind of get certificates. So it's really engaging people on a variety of levels in participating in a project that's going to yield real value for making many years of weather data available for use by anyone who wishes to access it. In another talk, David Clifford, who's the CEO of a company called Patients Like Me, and the website is www.patientslikeme.com, and he gave just this fascinating talk. The website is a place for individuals to record what they describe as their disease journey. Some of the diseases that are covered are ALS, or Lou Gehrig's disease, Parkinson's, and AIDS, and other diseases. So at this website, they collect structured data on patients. It includes medications, side effects, quality of life, depression, the latter two recorded through standard instruments. It's very detailed, and the patients revisit the website on a regular schedule to add information about their side effects and their medications, surgeries, state of health, etc. So there's this huge amount of data that they aggregate. This data of experience about patients with a particular disease, so that the company can aggregate the data and use it with physicians and probably drug companies and others. In the community fora, the patients report on how they benefit from participation in the site. For example, they've said that someone, for example, with epilepsy who'd been treated by a primary physician and wasn't having outcome from the medication that he wished, from the support of others with epilepsy in the forum, asked the primary physician to refer them to a specialist. Now, this may seem a very routine thing to many of us, but we have to remember that many patients are living in rural areas where they don't have the kind of access that some have to healthcare. And also, this is an international website, and he showed us one patient, for example, from Latin America. So they are able to get information from other patients all around the world. Now, here's one of the fascinating things to me. So you think, okay, there's this huge amount of anecdotal data. What's it about? Who's actually using it? What is it for? The organization has published a study in Nature Biotechnology based on the data they've collected. And it came about because one of the patients participating in the site asked a question of other ALS patients on the effectiveness of a particular drug that was receiving a lot of attention. And so the owners of the site decided to analyze the detailed logs that people were contributing about their use of the drug, and then they published this site in a peer-reviewed journal. So I found that very interesting. Part of the reason they felt they could do it is they said that 10% of all ALS patients are members of their site, and therefore they felt they had better participation and better data on more people than many studies that would have taken place in, you know, under the auspices of a research institution. Another interesting aspect of the presentation was that there was absolutely no discussion of privacy. And so I would love to have a follow-up conversation with him about that. In the open sessions of the Birdie meeting, they addressed a variety of issues, such as training for and recognition of work on data management. And those of us in the academic environment know that that's a key issue. How do we get professionals to be involved in managing and curating data from the beginning of research projects through the end? How do we train them, and how are they going to be given stature and positions within the university? Mike Keller of Stanford talked about library support for the processing of and management of research data, and talked about the need for developing capabilities for automatic extraction of metadata from large data sets and related materials. He's a member of the Birdie board, as is Chris Borgman, who just recently gave the Paul Evan Peters lecture at our last CNI meeting, and she noted that social sciences studies that yielded information about the data practices of scientists were needed in order to better understand how we might approach automated data extraction. So we need to understand these practices first before we can develop the automated solutions or try out the automated solutions. And she mentioned that IMLS is funding some work in this area. So that's a really quick roundup of that meeting. Both Cliff and I would be happy to answer your questions or talk with you further or email with you further about these and any other topics related to our CNI agenda. We can be reached at joan@cni.org and cliff@cni.org. Thanks so much for joining us today. I hope you're enjoying your summer and may head out on vacation soon, and I also may see some of you at the ALA annual conference. Thanks for listening to CNI Conversations. Bye-bye.